Welcome back to Current State, Mid-Michigan's home for the informed, the caring, and the curious. I'm Mark Bayshore. We come to you twice daily on 90.5 FM, that is at 9 a.m. and at 6 p.m., and every day at noon on AM 870 WKAR. We hope you can stick around. Live music today. Typically, our live music day is Friday. Today is an exception with Johnny Gandelsman in town. Johnny Gandelsman, great violinist, performs live for us here in Studio S later this hour. We begin today's program with a story that wasn't on anyone's radar yesterday at this time. Two members of the board that oversees the Lansing Board of Water and Light have called for a meeting to discuss whether General Manager Peter Lark should be running Lansing's city-owned utility. That meeting is set for 4:30 this afternoon at BWL headquarters on South Washington. Our first guest broke that news last evening on LSJ.com. The Lansing State Journal, Stephen Reed, joins me briefly now. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Mark.
Glad you could join us here. When you first learned that this meeting would be held, did it surprise you, or have you been aware that concerns with Lark were brewing?
The surprise for me came about a month ago when I interviewed the mayor, Mayor Bonero, in mid-December for an anniversary story on the ice storm. He said the number of errors and failures that took place a year earlier was beyond reasonable, and that they raised the mistakes raised questions about management. The mistakes were a year old, and to invoke them now was unexpected. He also said he was not done trying to figure out what went wrong. I asked him if he was saying that accountability was still possible at this relatively late date, and his answer was cryptic but revealing. He said, stay tuned. And so I've been wondering since then and working to find out since then what was going on. So the meeting is something that has been in the works for at least weeks and maybe even a couple of months.
You and I have both spoken with BWL Board President David Price as well. What has Mr. Price shared with you?
Well, not much beyond what I reported yesterday. He says he's lost confidence in Mr. Lark's leadership of the Board of Water and Light. But he and the other commissioners that I spoke to yesterday were vague. I just don't think they're ready to go public with their concerns beyond saying loss of confidence.
Well, I will share with you, I did have a chance to check in with Commissioner Dennis Lowney about 15 or 20 minutes ago this morning, and he did share with me, he said, quote, he was, quote, not supportive of continuing with the general manager. It's the reason that he's one of the two that called for the hearing. He went on to say he has not talked with all the commissioners, but he thinks that there is a consensus for change. Last July, Stephen, there was only one vote for not renewing Mr. Lark's contract. I'm fairly sure that came from board member Cynthia Ward. Today's meeting was called for by two other board members. Have you done the math as to whether there is the necessary five votes to fire Peter Lark?
Well, I've been working on the math, Mark, and it's still a little bit of a mystery, but I feel like that the meeting would not have been called if the commissioners who called it weren't fairly confident of the math. It takes five votes. This meeting might have been called a month ago if the commissioners who seek a change felt like that they could win at that time or prevail at that time. For it to happen now makes me think that they've decided that they can prevail.
Okay. We will know more come this evening. Stephen Reed reports on the Lansing Board of Water and Light for the Lansing State Journal. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The Michigan Supreme Court begins hearing arguments today involving two disputed laws passed during the first term of Governor Rick Snyder. First, justices will consider whether the state's recent right-to-work law, which eliminated the payment of union dues as a condition of employment, also applies to unionized state employees. Second, it will explore whether the state exceeded its authority back in 2011, when Michigan pensioners became subject to a 4% contribution from their pay in order to keep full benefits. To revisit the details of these cases, along with what the justices will likely be considering, Current State welcomes back Professor Devin Schindler, constitutional law expert on the faculty of Western Michigan University Cooley Law School. We also welcome back Dr. John Beck, associate professor in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations here at Michigan State University. Devin, John Beck, welcome back. John Beck, we'll start with you. Let's review the basics of the right to work case. Governor Snyder, of course, signed right to work into law 2 years ago after a very contentious debate and sometimes violent protest. Remind our listeners what's happened between then and now.
Well, just to make sure that we're all on the same page, right to work comes out of federal law. There's a state-by-state decision that can be made under Section 14B of Taft-Hartley, which allows states to decide whether or not they want to make a what is now called a right-to-work kind of law for their specific state. It's one of the few kind of state-by-state carve-outs in labor law of this sort. When the state legislature passed right to work, it was passed on the notion that it would be a boon to economic development. And I believe that the political undertone for that passage had to do with the fact the strength of public sector unions. Public sector unions are some of the strongest, members in relation to the overall labor movement. So in that way, when it was passed in December of 2012, I think that there was both on the one side great hope, maybe in the Republican camp, that there would be some kind of boon to overall economic development. And on the other side, I think there was a fear that there would be a plummet in labor union membership here in the state of Michigan. I don't believe either has necessarily come to pass as a result of right to work. The specific Supreme Court case turns on a very, very particular notion, that is that state workers are covered by the Civil Service Commission and that the actual passage of right to work goes against the state constitution, which gives sole authority to the Public Service Commission for the purpose of actually handling public sector labor law.
Let's bring Professor Schindler in here on this and take that point a little bit deeper. Professor Schindler, the state employees' unions then, are they arguing in this case that it is the Civil Service Commission that has precedence? Is that really what this case turns on?
Yes, essentially that is correct. This is a legal issue that only a law professor could love, because at first glance there would appear to be a certain inconsistency in the Michigan Constitution. Not to bore the listeners, but essentially Article 11, Section 5 of the Michigan Constitution vests with the CSC exclusive authority to regulate all conditions of employment. The unions are arguing, in essence, that this particular language at first glance gives them plenary authority, absolute authority to set the conditions of employment, including but not limited to the condition of whether or not you have to pay union dues. The supporters of the law, however, point to Section 4, Article 4 of the Constitution, Section 49, which, generally speaking, gives the legislature the authority to pass laws relative to the hours and conditions of employment. So I have one provision of the Constitution would suggest that the CSC, Civil Service Commission, has plenary authority to regulate the conditions of employment, but I have another section of the Constitution which suggests that the legislature has the right to pass laws relative to the conditions of employment.
Okay.
So I have an internal conflict here, what would appear to be an internal conflict in the Constitution.
Our current state guest, Professor Devin Schindler, constitutional law expert on the faculty of Western Michigan University Cooley Law School, and Dr. John Beck of the Michigan State University School of Human Resources and Labor Relations. John Beck, talk to us a little bit more about the responsibilities of the Civil Service Commission. How much authority does it have over the conditions of employment for state workers?
Well, I would defer to my colleague. I'm not really an expert on civil service kind of considerations. Much of my work has to do much more with labor union structure and history and other things along that
line. Devin, can you help us out on that front?
Yeah, certainly. There's a number of statutes, including and constitutional language, that essentially says under the Constitution, that the Civil Service Commission can classify all positions, can set respective duties and responsibility, fix the rates of compensation, improve or approve or disapprove of disbursements, set up examinations and merits payment structures. Essentially, when you get into the details, who gets promoted, how much they get paid, grievances, things of that nature, the Civil Service Commission under the Constitution is vested with a great deal of authority to really set the sort of the I hate to say nitpicky, but the specific provisions of how much you get paid, how you get paid, how you get promoted, and things of that nature. And so the Constitution does give the Civil Service Commission pretty broad authority in a number of areas.
Okay. John Beck, let me ask you, how have, I do beg your pardon, how have Michigan's right-to-work laws changed the culture of labor relations in the state? Are we far enough into this period that we can see impact so far?
No, I think that it's still early for a number of reasons. First, right when the law was passed, there was an open period when a lot of contracts got renegotiated before the law took effect. And if people were under an existing contract, then those same kind of dues considerations stayed until the actual end of the contract period. So many contracts will not run out until this year or next year. That for the first time will then allow people not to be union members and still get the same benefits of a union contract, free riders, as they're often called by the labor movement. This specific case is interesting from the point of view that the argument about this case is really very, very particular and close, and it's not about whether or not anyone really either likes or dislikes right to work. It's about the application of the law in relation to civil service, as our law professor has pointed out. I think that an interesting parallel is that Indiana just upheld their right to work law on a different constitutional challenge that had to do with a kind of a what might be called a taking, that is, that the could the state compel someone to do something without compensation? Could they compel a union to, for example, continue to give benefits to non-members without compensation? That was just recently. The state was upheld in its right to work challenge unanimously by the Indiana State Court. Mm. So we've got two different, very, very different cases in terms of what's being argued. There's no question that people who are on one side or the other of liking or not liking right to work are finding different ways to try to challenge or uphold the law.
Interesting. Professor Schindler.
If I may, Professor Beck makes an excellent point. That at the end of the day, the argument in front of the Supreme Court isn't, or at least shouldn't be, a policy argument. Whether you like these laws, whether you don't like these laws, is really not the issue. Ultimately, the issue is who gets to decide, the legislature or the CSC?
Professor Schindler, let's quickly move on to the pension case. What arguments, what key arguments are in play here?
Well, the pension case is obviously a very interesting case, and it has to do with parts of the Constitution that limit the ability to restrict pensions. And, of course, we've got some issues with expenses and what we can afford and what we can't afford. And so it's a bit of a similar issue on exactly what is the interrelationship between the constitutional provisions and the protections our Constitution gives the pension workers and the legislature's ability, as well as all of government's ability, to interfere with those particular requirements.
John, public sector unions tend to be pretty powerful organizers. What are the political consequences of these decisions?
Well, the here in the state of Michigan, not unlike elsewhere, public sector unionization is at a higher rate than private sector unionization. So public sector unions are kind of the bulwark of a continuing labor movement by comparison. So nationwide, the public sector is a little over 35% organized. The private sector is just a little over 6% organized, for an overall unionization rate nationally of about 11%. But public sector unions are extremely important politically. They've been a large group through political action committees of support for Democratic candidates or friendly Republican candidates. And they are one of the few large money kind of groups that's in opposition to the Koch brothers and others in relation to political spending. So in that fashion, trying to keep them busy with signing up members rather than turning their attention to other matters, the kind of the day-to-day internal organizing responsibilities in right-to-work states, that, I think, is really the overall political subtext that was part of this.
We want to thank our guest. Dr. John Beck is Associate Professor in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations here at Michigan State. Professor Devin Schindler joins us on the line as well. He is a constitutional law expert on the faculty of Western Michigan University Cooley Law School. Dr. Beck, Dr. Schindler, many thanks.
Pleasure is mine.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Green energy has made big strides in Michigan over the past several years. That's thanks in large part to a 2008 law that required the state to get 10% of its energy from renewable sources by 2015. That 10 by 2015 mandate is about to expire, and the state is on track to meet its goal. But what happens next? Can Michigan continue its move toward renewables? Or will efforts to green the energy industry stall without a legislative mandate? A report released today by the University of Michigan Energy Institute tries to answer those questions. Joining us to talk about the report and the future of renewable energy in Michigan is co-author Jeremiah Johnson, who's also an assistant professor at University of Michigan's School of Natural Resources. Welcome back to Current State, Jeremiah.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me on.
As I mentioned a moment ago, the 10 by 2015 mandate is set to expire this year. A proposed amendment to the Michigan Constitution in 2012 would have required the state to adopt 25% of renewables by 2025, but it failed. So what's next for Michigan when it comes to renewable energy policy? Does the state have any plans about how they'll move forward?
Well, Mark, our study found there's a great opportunity to expand that renewable standard. That 2008 RPS that you mentioned that went into effect, it was met with some skepticism when it passed, and there were some warnings of large increases to electricity prices. And what we saw was that the utilities and the generation developers really stepped up. We saw onshore wind contracts coming in at lower than expected prices, and the renewable energy surcharges that were expected were reduced or ultimately eliminated. So a lot cheaper than expected, although that ballot initiative a couple years ago failed. And so at the Energy Institute, we wanted to put out a neutral examination of what some alternative futures for RPS could look like, what the impacts for emissions would be, for costs, and the generation mix here in Michigan.
And basically you took different percentages and applied them to different timelines, is that correct?
That is correct. So we looked at ultimately achieving 20%, 25%, and 40% on varying timelines.
Mm-hmm. How does Michigan compare to the other states that have renewable energy standards?
Well, we're playing catch-up, I think. We were a little bit late to the game with the adoption of the first RPS, but we've executed against it well. So there are some states with far higher standards. There are some states with no standards at all. But what we found is that the resources that remain beyond that 10% are of good quality and can be developed in manners that have only a modest impact to ratepayers.
What does Michigan's energy portfolio look like right now here, January 2015? I mean, we're essentially near or at 10% renewables. Where does the other 90% come from?
A lot of coal. So over half of our generation is coal right now. We have a large contribution from from nuclear. Approximately one quarter of our generation is nuclear. A sizable but smaller contribution from natural gas, and then by the end of this year, we expect about 10% renewables, about half of that being wind, and the remainder being hydro, biomass, landfill gas.
How big a driver was the 10 by 2015 mandate as far as getting Michigan on a renewable energy path? Was that really the linchpin here, or would this have happened to some extent without it?
I don't think so. I think that the wind development in particular was driven by this mandate. So the utilities had to procure enough renewable energy to meet that 10% goal. And what we saw were some big utility scale onshore wind farms pop up as a direct result of this mandate.
Our guest is Jeremiah Johnson, assistant professor at U of M's School of Natural Resources. We're talking about a new report released today by the University of Michigan Energy Institute, which looks at alternative futures for Michigan with regard to renewable energy policies. I want to ask you, the new report looks at the impact of expanding the renewable portfolio standard. Can you tell us a little bit about how the three different scenarios compare to each other?
Sure thing. So we look at a scenario where we achieve 20% by 2030, so that would be doubling the standard. A scenario that gets 25% by 2025, something similar to that failed ballot initiative, and a target that gets 40% by 2035, so the most ambitious of the three. And what we saw for the first two, the 20% and the 25% targets, is that most of the cost-effective generation, renewable generation, to meet those standards would occur through more onshore wind. That's appears to be the best, most cost-effective renewable option that Michigan has to date. And the best resource is up in the Thumb. We have a big transmission project that is wrapping up right now that will help us access some of that resource. And what we saw in both of those scenarios is that the cost impacts were fairly modest, less than 2% increase to ratepayers for the 20% case and about a 3% increase in costs for the 25% case. So a typical household, a household that looks like mine, for the 25% case may have a $2.60 increase per month in their bill to double our renewables.
Hmm. Now, where are the utilities with regard to this? Are they what do they tend to make of those cost estimates?
Well, I think during the debate over the ballot initiative, the cost estimates were far higher. But in that interim time, what we've seen is a lot of the wind contracts that are actually signed, the real wind contracts for wind projects, have come in much lower than forecasted. We see wind contracts being signed for about $50 a megawatt hour, which is far, far lower than what was expected several years ago. We've also seen the utilities step up and develop and own their own wind generation. And so I think that there's a great opportunity for the utilities to ultimately be partners and champions for expanded renewables in the state.
To what extent, though, do they still resist this trend? Or can you objectively say that Michigan's utilities are enthusiastic partners in moving forward with renewable energy?
No, I think that the utilities are very sensitive to anything that would impact rates. So what I hope that this study does is shows that those impacts are quite modest and the opportunities for environmental improvement are quite large. And weighing those two things in tandem could suggest that the potential for those environmental benefits far outweighs the cost. You know, I think that reasonable people can come to different conclusions on this matter, but the small size of the rate impact here and the large environmental benefit hopefully will influence some to see that this is a positive approach.
How will EPA's recently released carbon emission standards impact how Michigan moves forward on renewable energy?
Great. So that is the elephant in the room. And right now we have the proposed Clean Power Plan, and we expect the final version of that plan perhaps this summer. And that plan, if it looks at all like the proposed plan, will call for really large reductions in the carbon intensity, the CO2 per megawatt hour of energy produced in Michigan. And there are a few ways to meet that. The EPA suggests efficiency either through consumer-side efficiency or efficiency at power plants. You could do fuel switching, so coal to natural gas is a viable option to reduce carbon emissions. And then, of course, there are renewables. And what our study shows is that our most ambitious of the renewable targets, that 40% goal, would get us most of the way there if that final clean power plan looks like this, looks like the proposed version that's out there today.
We have been talking about a new report released today by the University of Michigan Energy Institute dealing with differing scenarios as far as Michigan's future and renewable energy in our state. Our guest has been a co-author of that report, Jeremiah Johnson, an assistant professor at U of M School of Natural Resources. Thanks for joining us, Jeremiah.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And coming up on Current State, you think you know the story of the billy goat. I don't mean the fabled curse that hangs over the Chicago Cubs. I mean the billy goat, a Marxist publication written a century ago by a socialist politician from Michigan, Guy Lockwood. We'll learn more about his extraordinary life. Plus, classical violinist Johnny Gandelsman joins us here in Studio S. That and more after the break on Current State.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Ari
Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Listen every morning on the way to work between 5 and 9 on 90.5 WKAR.
For keeping on top of the news.
You're listening to the BBC World Service.
I'm Robin Lustig.
I'm Julian Marshall.
This is Owen Bennett-Jones
with NewsHour.
For finding out what's happened.
They're out on the stage, the protest leaders, still trying to rally their supporters.
And for knowing why it's happened.
They've often then turned to the Taliban as another way of earning a living.
Stay in touch with the world with NewsHour from the BBC.
This afternoon at 4 on AM 870 WKAR.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is 90.5 WKAR and AM 870 WKAR. Artist, teacher, writer, politician, Kalamazoo's Guy Lockwood was all these. Lockwood's early 20th century Socialist Party views were the focus of his political cartoons. His confrontational work challenged the American status quo in his regular pamphlet entitled The Billy Goat. Guy Lockwood was soon butting heads in the political arena. He became one of the first Michigan socialists voted to office. Lockwood served as a Kalamazoo alderman after his 1912 election. Kalamazoo historian William Breaksma published the article Guy Lockwood, a Socialist in Southwest Michigan, in a recent Michigan History magazine issue. Breaksma spoke with WKAR's Peter Wharf about how, in the course of his research, he was attracted to Lockwood's Billy Goat publication.
Both visually, since they were illustrated, and content, and of course the Kalamazoo connection.
So the Billy Goat was really what we know as some of the main body of Guy Lockwood's work. Can you sort of describe what the Billy Goat was? They were pamphlets, but they were an opportunity for him to publish his art and his writings.
They were. He had worked as an illustrator and sometime writer for a short period of time, quite successful socialist news magazine in Kansas. Girard, Kansas was the site. The writer there had wrote columns with his alter ego called the his one hoss philosophy.
Right.
With pithy statements about the economy, and he and Lockwood eventually came to a parting of the ways, and eventually Lockwood found his way to Kalamazoo. When he began writing here in Kalamazoo, he created his own version of the one hoss philosophy called the Billy Goat. And it was attempt to write in common sense and rather unadorned language the complaints of the working man and the wrongs foisted on them by the evil capitalists. And so he called his ego the Billy Goat, and the Billy Goat, I don't have my article right in front of me, but he butted in anywhere that he wanted to.
Bill, I found a quote from your article which sort of illustrates that folksy style from the Billy Goat, the series of pamphlets that you described. And you write in your article, as the principal writer for the Billy Goat publications, Lockwood sometimes adopted a folksy style. Quote, "Now you wouldn't think to look at him, but the Billy Goat is of an artistic sort of mind. Sort of leans toward the aesthetic, whatever that means. It's a term I once heard and often repeat because it seems to lend dignity to my otherwise blunt way of saying things."
Yeah. I think that was drawn pretty much from a newspaper in Kansas as well. It's the same sort of folksy attitude, but attempting to project some intellectualism as well.
You describe socialism's way into the U.S. through Northern Europe, and
yeah.
This coincides with the time that Guy Lockwood was developing his own worldviews. Can you sort of describe how this, you know, basically how this movement happened in Northern Europe to come to the U.S. and sort of set us in the times?
It was, of course, this was a time when large corporations came to dominate the economies of Western Europe and the United States. And it was before the Sherman antitrust laws. Monopolies were not, well, they hadn't existed until the mid-1800s, and they weren't initially thought of as bad things. But the monopolists, and particularly the factory owners, accumulated a great deal of wealth and power and really took advantage of working men. Large numbers of socialists were expelled from Germany by Bismarck, the chancellor there, and they settled in the United States, particularly in a lot of eastern states and cities in the United States in the late 1800s.
And then these views meshed with Guy Lockwood's worldview. Eventually, he rose to Kalamazoo alderman. Can you tell us about that path?
Yes, he came here initially to become a partner in an art school. He was an artist as well as a street corner politician. So while he was running his art school, first with a partner and then on his own, he also became involved in Socialist Party politics here in Kalamazoo. He did a lot of speaking and writing. He attended some Socialist Party national conventions, became more and more prominent around town, and his rise really coincided with the rise of the Socialist Party nationally. Eugene Victor Debs was the leading national politician of the Socialist Party, but there were others, and he had run as a candidate for president a couple times. By 1912, the party had gotten as prominent as it was ever going to be. Debs ran for president and received, I think, about 6% of the national vote. At that same year, Lockwood ran for city commissioner, for alderman, and rode the wave of the attractiveness of the Socialist Party into office.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with William Braxma, the author of the recent Michigan History magazine article, Guy Lockwood, a Socialist in Southwest Michigan. Could you describe a cartoon or two that maybe exemplifies his views and his artistic style combined?
Well, there's one that appears in one of his tracts, which is of a working man, a laborer, a certainly blue-collar laborer, a laborer, a big brawny guy, bent over with the globe on his shoulder, on his shoulders, and on top of the globe was a fat capitalist. Think the Monopoly, the banker in the Monopoly card game, wearing spats and a top hat and smoking a cigar while the laborer carries the whole world on his back. I thought that really encapsulated his political views and his artistic style.
You've put Lockwood's rise to local office in the context of the rising socialist movement in the United States in the early 20th century. Talk a little bit about some of these socialist views that Lockwood had in terms of personal property. What were his views about ownership of personal property and sort of the distinctions between public and private?
He did not at all oppose, of course, personal ownership of private property, but he was in favor, and this was the Socialist Party position as well, of public ownership of areas of the economy, railroads, financial institutions, mines, and the like. He was in accord with the views of the National Party and really did not like at all capitalists. Some of his private writings, letters to friends and acquaintances spoke rather harshly of capitalists, even into his later years.
It seems like another part of his view would almost be described today as sort of a Green Party agenda as it related to his thoughts about public parks and farmers markets.
That's true. And that was also not at all uncommon for socialists running in for municipal offices. Of course, national ownership of railroads and mines and power companies wasn't feasible on the municipal level. So a lot of socialist candidates ran their local campaigns on things that would benefit their blue-collar supporters, and those included parks, a lot of parks for that were accessible to blue-collar workers. It didn't exist at that time. At public transportation as well. I guess those all fall into the general category of things that would benefit blue-collar workers who had really been ignored by the major parties up till that time.
Guy Lockwood, a socialist in Southwest Michigan. William Braxma, thanks for telling us about this interesting character in Michigan history.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us here for Current State on Tuesday. Violinist Johnny Gandelsman was born in Moscow into a family of musicians. His father, Yuri, is a professor of viola here at Michigan State University. His mother, Jana, is a pianist, and his sister, Natasha, is a violinist as well. Johnny Gandelsman is well known for his roles in the string quartet Brooklyn Rider and the multifaceted Silk Road Ensemble, two of today's notable stereotype-defying music groups. Gandelsman performs one of his instrument's most soul-searching and technically challenging bodies of work tonight and tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the MSU Union, Johann Sebastian Bach's Sonatas and Partitas for Solo Violin. Here on Current State, Johnny Gandelsman. Live from Studio S here on WKAR's Current State, violinist Johnny Gandelsman, who performs tonight and tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at the MSU Union. He'll be performing J.S. Bach's Sonatas and Partitas for solo violin. What did we just hear?
You just heard a movement from the third partita in E major. The movement is called Lure, and it's just one of those beautiful, elegant dances.
Indeed. What do you think that these pieces, the sonatas and partitas for solo violin, what do they represent in the violin universe?
Well, I think Bach, you know, who himself was a great violinist, really explores all the possibilities of the instrument through the pieces, from the, you know, the beauty of these dances to the incredible polyphony of the fugues. And the depths of emotion that can exist in one single instrument.
So lightness and a depth of emotion as well.
Absolutely.
On opposite ends of the spectrum. What particular challenges do you face as the featured artist when performing this complete body of work in a single performance?
Well, I've just started doing this. I've had a chance to perform all of them in the last few weeks about four times. And so I'm learning each time that I do it, I learn something new. And
is it a harder performance? Is it a more physically demanding performance getting through these pieces?
In some ways. I mean, it's about 2 hours and 15 minutes of music. Mm. So there's, you know, there's memorization involved and pacing. Most importantly, I what I'm working on right now is I'd like to be in the right state of listening right from the very beginning. And that has been getting better from night to night. So I'm hoping tonight will be a good one.
Listening as you're performing.
Yes.
How has the violin world, how has its approach to Bach's sonatas and partitas today changed compared to, say, 40 or 50 years ago?
Well, you know, I think now was the beautiful resurgence of the Baroque movement. There's just much more openness to different ways one can perform these pieces. You know, about 40, 50 years ago, I think what you mostly heard is romanticized version of the pieces, which is beautiful in its own way. But I think now people are finding more freedom to look back to kind of the original way these pieces might have been performed, and
that's less romantically. What does that add up to?
I mean, there's some technical things. You know, one may use less vibrato, or the tempos may be a little bit faster.
I understand. Yeah, your string quartet, Brooklyn Rider, seeks to break the bounds of the typical classical string quartet. What are some of the ways that you build on Haydn and Mozart and Beethoven and Bartok and the many contributors to this musical conversation?
Well, you know, what we do with the quartet is we definitely play works from the traditional classical repertoire, as you mentioned, Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven. But we also play a lot of new music. We commission a lot of new music. We've premiered probably over 40 or 50 works. We also do a lot of collaborations with musicians outside of classical music. And so what that does is it puts us in a different, again, listening state, and puts us a little bit outside of our comfort zone, but that's kind of the place where a lot of learning can happen. And from those collaborations, we can then take a lot of things back to performing a string quartet by Beethoven.
Sounds like it creates a lot of sparks.
Absolutely.
Good, productive, creative sparks.
Absolutely.
Tell us about your other groups. You're involved in several ensembles, the Knights, Silk Road Ensemble.
Right.
Tell us about each of those.
Well, Silk Road Ensemble is a collective of musicians from around the world that was brought together by Yo-Yo Ma. And it's the group has been around for 15 years already. And again, this is a group that explores a little bit of, you know, what's precious and dear to someone else. And when you learn that one special thing, it brings you closer to understanding the other person. And so we learn about each other's traditions and explore what's possible together.
Sounds very exciting. Well, we want to thank you, Johnny Gandelsman, for joining us here today at an hour that's probably not always easy to make magic, but you've made it very special here for us today, and we appreciate that a great
Thank
deal.
You very much. I have two kids, so this hour is nothing.
We want to correct some misinformation we spread out there just a few minutes ago, too, regarding your performances. Your performances take place at the Cook Recital Hall in the Music Building, MSU College of Music, not at the MSU Union, and they are set for 7:30 p.m. this evening and tomorrow evening. We will let you retake the microphone because we're going to have Johnny Gandelsman play us out of our program. That wraps up Current State for today. Tomorrow, Congressman Mike Bishop joins us. He's been a congressman for really just a matter of days. We get an update from Congressman Mike Bishop. Also, Kevin Lavery gets up close and personal, well, not too close, with the two new brother wolves at the Potter Park Zoo in Lansing. That comes up Wednesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Johnny Gandelsman plays us out. It's Current State on WKAR.